Welcome back to FMI's Built-In Podcast, and thank you for listening. I'm your host, Scott Winstead, FMI Consulting President. Today's episode is all about getting succession right. At its core, succession is about finding the right ownership transition and management succession formula. Both are critical, but if you don't have the people, and if those people aren't ready or capable, the math really doesn't matter. That's the challenge with succession. You can't just solve for the numbers. You have to also solve for the humans. And I can't think of two better guests to walk us through this critical topic than my colleagues Jake Appleman and Matt Godwin. Jake is a partner in our leadership and organizational development practice and the leader of our management succession sub-practice. He brings a sharp, people-first lens to the challenge of preparing the next generation of leaders. He's worked with hundreds of industry firms to build stronger leadership teams and deeper leadership pipelines. And specific to our topic today, has helped leaders navigate the complex human side of management succession. He's also one of the most thoughtful question askers I know. He has a near superhuman ability to cut through the noise and get right to the heart of an issue. Jake doesn't just make you think, he makes you think deeply and really wrestle with the hard stuff, whether you want to or not. And in my experience, that's really where the real work and the real progress begins. Matt is a managing director with FMI Capital Advisors and leads our ownership transition practice. Like Jake, he's worked with hundreds of industry firms to structure transitions that work both on paper and in practice. What sets Matt apart is his ability to simplify complexity. He helps owners see around corners, avoid the common pitfalls, and make confident, informed decisions. He brings a calm, steady presence to what can sometimes be an emotionally charged process and has a gift for helping leaders move from intention to action. At FMI, we believe great succession involves both sides of the equation. It's not just about who owns the company next. It's about who leads it. And it's about equipping them to take up the mantle and move the business successfully into its next chapter. In this episode, we explore what great looks like, what can sometimes go wrong, and how to get the math, the mindset, and the process right. Let's dive in. Well, Jake, Matt, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here. Well, I'd love to start out with a couple of questions for both of you. And then as we go, we'll kind of segment it based on your various areas of expertise. But just to start out, and maybe Jake, I'll start with you. You both worked with firms at all stages of the succession journey. I'm curious how you would each define what the markers are of a truly great transition process.
One is that it's a normal part of the process. I think of the example of a large trade contractor that I work with, and they treat succession like it were any other business process. So instead of it being a one-time, highly emotional, challenging event, it's just what they do. And so they treat it the same way they treat project reviews or a business plan. And they review it every single year. They evaluate the talent they've got. There's a high level of visibility into it. And it's just part of their natural culture and systems and processes and disciplines. It's not something new or distinct or separate from what they do on a day-to-day basis. And I think about that in comparison to another company that I worked with where we remember very vividly we were in the boardroom. And we started asking questions about succession, and it went dead silent in the room. As have you ever heard that saying of you could hear a pin drop? This was that. And I could just tell right away that this company had never had those kinds of conversations. So it was a dead contrast to the example I gave before, where it was something they hadn't talked about and they hadn't brought it up and they didn't have the systems and processes to work with.
Those are two great examples and two really stark contrasts that we see quite a bit. Just a quick follow-up question. The first example you shared, the firm that treats it as a process and part of the fabric of the place, was that an evolution that they got to, or is that just how they incorporate everything that they would put kind of on the strategic agenda bucket?
Absolutely was a process. So that's another piece that predicts success is you've done this before. One of the hardest situations to make transition work is the first-time founder who's going through succession for the first time. So this organization had been through multiple iterations of it. They made mistakes. Think very clearly of an example where they picked a leader who was not the right leader. And so they learned from their experiences. It's not brand new.
Matt, just switching over to the other part of the equation, you know, the ownership transition side, what makes a truly great transition process?
Kind of think of it from the standpoint of perspective in a way. I mean, on the ownership side, you're dealing with capital and you're dealing with the money aspect of this. But, you know, I think a business owner going through transition has to think about kind of what the core objectives that they're solving for are. It's kind of hard to create the answer if we don't know what the real question is. So I think kind of a deep understanding of what you're trying to solve for is critical. But from a perspective standpoint, understanding where your company sits today and what those key needs are from a leadership perspective, from a capital allocation perspective, and what that strategy is going forward really plays into it, because you have to understand kind of what the capital needs for the business are down the road so that you can consider what, you know, valuation methodology you're going to use and other factors. The other thing, you know, Jake mentioned kind of mistakes and iterations. I think to expand on that a little bit, you know, this is more of a process. It's not exactly a transaction. So you need to have some flexibility built into it. So I kind of look at it as, here are the guardrails that you put in place to shape where the company is going from an ownership transition standpoint. And that allows you to kind of mitigate things as the market changes or as you have different shifts in the business or with people.
That's great, Matt. Just sticking with you for a second, from your experience in working with clients, what advice do you find yourself giving most often?
First of all, it's understanding that there will be a certain level of sacrifice involved in this process. Having that next generation come in and buy the business or participate in the earnings stream to buy the business down the road, you know, there's usually going to be a little bit of a give there from a valuation standpoint. And one of the best comments I've ever heard around this was a family business owner that was, I think, the fourth generation, and she was moving it to the fifth. And the response was, my aim here is to make sure that that next generation goes forward. So that aim of that person was not to maximize valuation or change the shift in the business model. It was more along the lines of maintaining this business and having a correct ownership transition structure and valuation structure that made sense. So I think that's a big part of it, just in terms of understanding that there probably will be a little bit of a give. The other thing is what we call the balance of capital. And, you know, as you think about transition, you have to think about it from the standpoint of your business needs, because transition is going to require a use of future cash flows to fund the transaction. But then you've got other things, balance sheet needs, growth needs, organizational needs, CapEx needs, those type of things. So you kind of have to balance that with distributions, cash flows, et cetera. So it's really that balance of capital going forward.
Just really quickly, Matt, I guess how often when you have these conversations with owners, are they clear-eyed with regard to their objectives when they start the discussion versus you have to go through some sort of discovery and facilitate a dialogue to kind of get them to shape those objectives?
I'd say 90% of the time we have to shape the objectives.
Okay.
Just because, to Jake's point earlier, when you've got someone that's transitioning for the first time, they really don't know what needs to be addressed. And there are a number of pillars of transition, a number of critical factors that you need to go through. And you're not just solving for one thing. It's a lot more holistic than that. I mean, it's not just an estate planning exercise, as an example. So we spend a lot of time trying to figure out exactly what, you know, what we're solving for and what's most critical from the owner's needs, but also from the needs of that next generation that'll be buying in.
I think I've heard both of you over the years say, people, profits, and time. You know, if you got those three things, it's easy, right? Nothing to it.
That's right.
In 20 years, I've never seen a succession plan that actually goes to the plan. There is a guarantee that things will change. What I have seen are things like an owner unexpectedly passing away, going through the process. I've seen leaders pull out of the business and go somewhere else, take another opportunity. I've seen sons or daughters who they thought were going to be the successors realize that they don't have support in the organization and can't move forward. I've seen owners who can't figure out their own personal financial needs in the business and can't step away. The thing I can tell you, there's not a lot of certainties in succession planning, but I can't tell you with great certainty that the plan will change. And so the most powerful thing you can have in place is clarity of what you want to accomplish, and then a strong bench of leaders. And as Matt mentioned, one of the things we tend to uncover through conversations is what's realistic and what's not. We have conversations all the time where an owner may be 65 years old and they want out in 2 years, but they haven't transferred any equity and they haven't identified their next generation of leader. That's a very hard conversation that we're going to have. Or leaders who have unrealistic expectations of the value of their business, or unrealistic expectations of the talent beneath them. So there's a whole series of just hard conversations that we have to have in this. And so one piece of advice I would give would be start early, have a lot of options available. The greatest option you can possibly have is a deep bench of talent. And the last one is just buckle up for lots of hard conversations. I have not yet had one of these where you haven't had to have five or six really hard conversations. And that's usually what's holding things back. This is the five or six conversations that you just don't want to have, but you have to if you want to get this right.
It's the Mike Tyson rule. Everybody's got a plan until I punch him in the mouth, right? So exactly, you have a plan, but as soon as it gets released, it will change most assuredly. I saw something the other day that said, you know, progress is trying things, falling down, getting back up again, disguised as a straight line. So a lot of ups and downs and sideways twists and turns to ultimately make progress.
Right.
So when you see these succession plans go sideways, what's usually behind it if you had to narrow it down to a root cause or two?
Short answer there, Scott, it's almost always people issues. As important as the math is and the structure is, it's almost always a people issue that causes it to go sideways. And lots of examples there. In a lot of cases, it would be an owner who's not ready to transition out. And so we regularly see owners who either leave too early or they stay too long or they disrupt the process because they're not ready to go. Often see unrealistic expectations about who really has it when it comes to being an owner. So we create a really clear distinction between ownership in terms of equity and ownership mentality, or ownership, the psychology of ownership is a huge difference. So that can cause things to go sideways. If you give ownership too early before someone has ownership mentality, can cause all kinds of problems. Unrealistic expectations about who's going to lead the business. One of the things we often do in this process is we ask the hard questions that are getting ignored. So we may sit down with leaders and say, who do you see as the next generation leader? And when we hear a different answer from key operational people versus the answer we hear from the primary owner, we're in trouble. And there's going to be some pretty significant issues there. Family businesses, lots of challenging dynamics in those in terms of who's seen as a future owner. And sometimes we talk about the difference between, are you a family that has a business or are you a business that has a family? I've seen lots of challenges that cause things to go sideways that way.
Matt, you know, when you see these things go sideways, what typically is the cause?
I think number one would be companies or owners that are solving for a specific value that they're trying to obtain out of the business. When you think about transition, you're looking at it from a forward lens, and valuation is one thing, but it's really, you know, you're going to get paid, you're going to get compensated, or you're going to sell your shares via sharing the earnings stream of the future business. So the value you're going to get out of it has a number of different components, but the value you get out of it is what the business produces. And we've seen a number of situations where companies or an owner is saying, this is the amount I want, and the business doesn't support it. And that just causes all kinds of problems, and it stunts the business, frankly. That's one. The other is kind of going back to the word of trust. I mentioned this is a process. We can put together any sort of transition, quote unquote, deal, right? Where we've got a buy sell agreement and a plan that says this is exactly how it's going to go. But at the end of the day, the market's going to change. You and Jake just talked about this. You're going to have shifts. There's going to be something that changes over this timeline, right? Because it's very difficult to project the next 5 years of your business. This is a construction industry. It's hard. So that trust play between the partners, between the buyers, between the sellers, within the organization, the fact that things need to be communicated, that's a big part of it. Because if you don't start with that, it's hard to get it back. And you have to trust that decisions are going to be made the right way, especially as it relates to control and governance, which are two very important things in this process, because there will be shifts. So those are two things. The other thing is these businesses evolve, and every engineering and construction firm follows an evolution and a growth path. And at each stair step, right, there's a different level of professionalization, a different need for capital, different maybe different leadership needs. So each evolution of the business maybe portends to a different evolution of ownership. So you need to be a little wide-eyed just in terms of maybe thinking about other ownership options as you progress.
Next couple of questions, I want to, Jake, kind of pick on your expertise here a little bit. And you touched on this with your very first answer. But as you think about consulting and advising clients, how should companies think about integrating succession into their culture and systems so it's not just a one-time event and it's not just viewed as we've just got to replace the CEO?
Part of that has to do with the maturity and the size of the business, the readiness for it. So many will naturally think of succession as we're purely replacing the CEO or the president. And if I figure that out, everything else will just work fine. And in many cases, we listen for, they think about succession in terms of the lines and boxes on an organizational chart. And that happens regularly. And so sometimes we'll see clients say, well, I've got it all figured out. Here's my org chart. And I've got a name in a box and it looks nice and clean and even. But the reality is in most organizations, especially small to mid-sized firms, anybody you would pull to step into increased responsibility is a key leader already in your organization. It's your best estimator. It's your best project manager. It's your best engineer. It's the person who's running your most profitable business unit. Those are the people who you would naturally bring up into an enterprise level leadership role. So part of that is thinking through the second, third order implications and making sure they're aware of the corresponding actions that would happen when you start moving leaders up. And then a lot of it too is having clarity around roles and responsibilities in the organization and building out a systematic approach. So the best organizations we see, they have great clarity on the roles and responsibilities. They evaluate leaders accurately. They get multiple perspectives as they evaluate leaders. If you don't have multiple perspectives, you're most likely to select a leader who looks just like you. And so you don't factor in the cycle of the business and what we need for the future. And so you end up with one leader picking another leader who looks just like them. So the great ones have clarity around their vision as an organization. They know where they want to go. They've got clarity around the types of leaders that they want, and they've got real rigor in terms of how they evaluate leaders. So it's not instinctive. They may use assessments. They may test people in key roles before they move into increased responsibility, but they've got multiple data points to evaluate people as well.
Interesting. When you think about org design and the lines and boxes that a lot of firms kind of get fixated on, be an interesting thought experiment to go back and for companies that have grown to a relative degree, going through succession, being able to define what those roles need to look like 10 years out. If you were to take an org chart snapshot of what it looks like today and then go back and find one from 10 years ago at that size, 15, 20 years ago, just to kind of get folks oriented to think, okay, we need to be designing this business and these roles for what it's going to be and where we're taking it versus where it is today, because I find you tend to play catch up when you're doing that.
That's right. It reminds me, Scott, of an example, a contractor that I worked with who it was first generation founder, and first generation founders tend to be highly entrepreneurial. That was this leader to his core, highly entrepreneurial, very charismatic, unbelievable tolerance for risk. And then when we started evaluating his successor, that was his model. And so he was looking around, he couldn't find anyone like him. And we had to have this conversation. You are one of one. There is nobody in your organization who's going to have that same level of risk tolerance and entrepreneurialism that you have. And so we had to have some really hard conversations and get his head wrapped around, you really need a systems builder and a process person and someone who's going to drive discipline for strategic planning and business planning and budgeting. And boy, that was just not very glamorous for him to look at that. And he said, that's the kind of leader I need. If you want to make this thing work, that's the kind of leader you need. It's not you.
It's like the Steve Jobs, Tim Cook transition, right?
That's right.
Very, very gifted in their own rights. Well, just to continue on that frame, how do you help CEOs or boards manufacture urgency in this process when there really isn't an immediate reason to act?
There usually has to be some sort of trigger to move things. And so it can be a lot of different things, but you really have to lock into one specific area. So the kinds of things that we see move, especially first generation owners, in many cases, it would be the business has gotten too big for me and I can't handle it. That creates a sense of urgency when you realize it's just outgrown me in a lot of ways. Health is a big one. So I can think of multiple companies where you have a brush with mortality and you realize you're not going to live forever and you realize you have to do something to be able to move the business. There's a burnout factor that we see with several owners as well when they just have this feeling of, I just can't get up in the morning at the same level of energy and commitment and passion that I used to have. Another one is risk. There are a lot of leaders who have just gotten comfortable with an exceptional level of risk. And there is some point for a lot of leaders when they wake up and they just go, I just can't handle this level of risk anymore. There's obligations. I always told my spouse that we were going to go on a world cruise or I was going to spend more time with the grandchildren. But what we found is you have to lock in on some of those key areas. For some leaders, it's legacy. This is my chance to really leave behind an enduring organization. Other leaders have no interest in that, but it's different in every case. And until you can lock in on the critical factor that's unique in each case, you're unlikely to get the urgency that you really need to move forward. And if you address the wrong issue, it's not going to move things.
I want to come back to the psychology that we talked about a little bit earlier and get you to kind of take us inside the mind of a founder or a transitioning CEO. And we'll kind of focus on that top level of this top level roles for the thought experiment. These are folks that are typically stepping away or making the decision to face the fact that they're going to be stepping away from their life's work. In your work with clients, you know, what do these conversations typically look like from a intellectual perspective, more so from an emotional perspective? Maybe just kind of walk us through what you've seen in some of these discussions.
My experience there, Scott, is most times you have to back into it. If you start with a conversation that sounds something like, hey, tell me about your sense of purpose and what's life like at home with your spouse and where do you find deep meaning? A lot of these leaders are going to look at you like you're crazy because they're thinking about the ownership transition, the financial aspect. They'll think in terms of organizational structure. So in a lot of cases, I've found you have to work your way up to it. You have to build trust first. You have to understand who they are and what their values are and what's most important. Look around their office and see what kind of pictures they have. But there's lots of data points out there that give you something to ask questions about. And it usually doesn't surface on the front end. And so one of the questions that I'll often ask is, what does finishing well look like for you? And if this goes really well in terms of the transition, what do you see your role being? Where do you get a sense of purpose in your work? And once we get closer, we ask questions about their personal lives. What does it look like at home? One of the things we found with a lot of owners is that their spouses have built a life of their own. And so when you think about the owner of a business who might be working 60, 70, 80 hours a week regularly, it's very common that their spouse, their children have built a life of their own. In the classic example I always get, I remember an owner that we worked with and he retired, sold his business. And then I remember following up with him a couple months later and I talked to his wife. And one of the things his wife said was, I'll never forget, he came down from upstairs and he slept in. It was like 7:30 in the morning. And he started telling me how to make coffee. And then she had to say, you got to remember, I am not one of your employees. So that was a hard conversation. But those are the kinds of things, if you haven't started to figure out, that you're going to run into all kinds of challenges. Whereas other leaders who have tested things out and piloted a life after the business tend to be much more successful. So if you think you might want to sit on boards, do it before you retire. If you think you might want to go into real estate development, try it first. If you think you might want to go into private equity, try that first. Because I can think of a lot of leaders who have these fantasies of what they're going to do, but they haven't actually tried it. And then they retire and they try it and they go, boy, that wasn't what I expected. That wasn't the thing that's going to fire me up. And if you haven't tried it first, you might get surprised by what you find on the other end. So we highly encourage that leaders have something that's inspiring, that they feel like they're going towards something versus running away from their business. Makes a huge difference if you're going towards something that gives you a sense of purpose, intellectual stimulation, and sense of fulfillment.
So critical. We've seen it a million times. You touched on this earlier, just to come back to it and go a little bit deeper. How do you distinguish between a leader who says they're ready, but who is not actually giving off the signals that they are actually ready?
A big indicator there is courage. Have they had the courage to start planning and having the hard conversations? The more I do this work, the more I think that courage is the critical factor. Because I mentioned earlier that to make this work, you've got to have 10 to 15 hard conversations. If a leader has shown a history of making the hard calls, there's a good indicator they're going to figure this out. If they're willing to face up to, I've got to reflect on my own purpose and values. I've got to think about what life looks like after this. That's a lot of courage to do that for anybody, to think about that next phase of life. What am I going to do that has significance and meaning in my life? What hard conversations am I going to have with my spouse and my kids about what's next for me as a leader? There's a huge level of courage in picking people who are going to be owners. Matt talked about this, but for most businesses we work with, you're going to have to pick people who are in and who are out when it comes to ownership. Incredibly hard. And we see lots of mistakes on things like, well, they've been around forever. They're very loyal. They're my best pick one, estimator, engineer, and I need to make them an owner. In many cases, you just haven't had the courage to say, look, you don't have ownership mentality. You're not going to be an owner in this business. That's really, really hard. There's a level of courage in picking leaders. There's no succession process that works well where you don't make hard calls about people. You've got to decide who's going to lead the organization, who's going to be a direct report of this person that maybe you were competing with to be the president or CEO of the organization. You have to have a hard conversation with a family member who might even be entitled and might feel like they're going to run the business, but doesn't have the support of the organization. It's the courage to be able to face up to hard conversations and to be able to put them into action versus pushing them off and delaying.
Just to tie a bow around this particular thought, what strategies have you found to be most effective in helping leaders frame that picture of what they will be doing beyond the big job that gets them excited to want to go run toward it?
It's having a plan. Scott, so I think of an example of a client that I'm working with right now, and I think he's done an extraordinary job of planning. And so we partnered together and put together a transition plan. So it's built from, he is a statement of his purpose. This is my purpose as a leader. These are my values as a leader. This is my envisioned future. So we actually went through an exercise where he wrote out, here's what I envision myself doing. Here's the impact I'm having when I think 5 to 10 years out. We got as specific as who am I influencing and who am I working with? What kinds of companies would I sit on their boards? Because he's very specific about the kinds of companies he wants to work with. And that's another mistake I see a lot of leaders make, is that they retire and then they instantly sit on 8 boards. And you just go, boy. And then you talk with them and they go, that was a mistake. I'm working with a bunch of companies I didn't want to work with in the first place. So having great clarity about what do you want to do? What kinds of industries, what kind of boards do you want to sit on? We got as granular as where does he want to live? And so he's wrestling with, where do I want to live? Where am I going to live out my purpose? But we actually put together it's about a 5 to 6 page document that's built out around starting place from his purpose and values and envisioned future. And he's still making his transition, but I'm very confident that's going to go well because he's done the work. He did the reflection. We built it together. He tested it with his spouse. He tested it with his kids. There's an actual plan in place. And you contrast that to, well, I'll figure it out. Don't worry about me. Those are the leaders that I see have all kinds of problems. And I'm working with one now where the leader is trying to come back into the business. So has retired and now is saying, well, what if I came back in some sort of business development role, or even I ran a project And I can tell you that is not going to work. So that's the contrast I would draw is, have you built a plan? Have you tested it? Is it built around your purpose and values? Or are you just going to retire and then hope that everything works out?
There's a now retired CEO that we all know, I've talked about a number of times. It's done this really well and talked about working with a coach to help him while he still was CEO. She had him track his time for the over the course of a month, and not with precision, but just three buckets. And I won't get this exactly right, but one is, these are the things I do because I love them. I do them for free, whether they paid me or not, because I'm passionate about it. And it was, for him, it was like training, developing employees, coaching, helping people reach their full potential. The middle bucket was something to the effect of, you know, these are the things you do because it comes staple to the CEO gig. You kind of, you have to do them. You don't love them. You don't hate them. You just do them. You plow through. And then the third bucket was, these are the things I do because I have to do them. But it really takes somebody to, I won't say exactly what he said, to get me to do these things because I can't stand them. And he said it was kind of remarkable over the course of a month of just tracking his time in these buckets. And then they started to kind of go through a discovery process and a discussion process over time to shape, okay, there are lots of things that I can do beyond this company where I could get lots of examples and lots of opportunities to do things that fell into that first bucket. And so he's kind of created his post CEO job description. And now he does a number of different things, including serve on some boards, does some coaching, consulting, and it's pretty interesting, but very thoughtful, very intentional process to get to that point where we had a plan.
You bring up a great point, Scott, is get help in this process. It is incredibly hard to navigate this by yourself. And those deeper questions aren't likely to be asked by your accountant. They aren't likely to be asked by your financial advisor. They aren't likely to be asked by your attorney. And so most of the executives we work with, they've got lots of advisors. They've got a board, they've got attorneys, they've got accountants and financial advisors. But it's very rare that someone's able to pull all these different complicated pieces together and untangle them, and then also ask the hard questions at a personal level. And so while many in our industry they're almost over-advised, it's not often the right kind of advising that ties all the things together in a way that winds through all these hard questions and comes up with a solution that means most to the person who's at the top.
That's a great point, Jake. And I want to segue now, Matt, into some of the ownership transition aspects of this equation. So when you think about ownership transition, what are the key ingredients that executives really need to understand to get it right?
Number one, ownership transition is a holistic process. It's not just one thing. It's not just estate planning. It's not just leader development, or it's not valuation or liquidity creation. It affects the entire organization. So there are a number of things to think about. I mean, we've touched on objectives. You know, defining your key objectives, very important. Is it legacy? Is it valuation? Is it, you know, broader ownership, things of that nature? Leadership development, obviously. But then going more toward the ownership part of it, it's understanding the feasible transition structures that are available for you. And it kind of comes back to a philosophy in a way, meaning, you know, what's the best way for this company to be owned? Because there's an alignment that needs to happen with a construction firm around aligning risk versus reward. Those that are potentially managing the key risk of the business are the ones that may need to be the core owners. But firms look at it different ways, right? I mean, if you look at the ENR 100, you're seeing a lot of transition over time through generations to broader ownership. So a lot comes with that. But, you know, understanding what's feasible from a structure and evaluation standpoint is very important. The other aspect that's very important to address is around kind of what's the strategy of the business. And I think that's one thing that a lot of businesses miss in terms of thinking about how do you mirror ownership as a strategy in a way, because it can be used that way, not just the strategy from a corporate standpoint, but using ownership as a tool, let's just say, to invigorate the troops, to have the right people aligned with driving the business, but also as potentially a retaining tool for employees that are critical to the business. So see that quite a bit. Taxation and estate planning is very important. So understanding the tax effects with this within ownership transition is critical, because you see different changes, you see different estate and gift tax changes. But the other thing too is you have to look at it in two different ways. ownership transition is not just the long-term transition, but you have to think about the short-term kind of more contingency planning in a way as well, because that is a critical thing that all businesses need to have in terms of what happens if something happens to a shareholder or the CEO, and having not just the leadership and the management aspect of that nailed down what happens if, but what happens to the ownership and making sure that their families are taken care of and the business continues in the way it should from an ownership standpoint. The other thing too to think about as kind of a pillar within this is kind of that next generation. Jake talked about shareholder criteria and entitlement and things of that nature. Shareholders, especially the newer shareholders, need to understand what it means to be a shareholder. And that's almost a philosophy too. Like, what does it mean to be a shareholder in this business? And that can be to grow value over time. It could be share profits and income streams on an annual basis, things of that nature. But the control part of it and understanding what it means to be maybe a minority shareholder versus a control shareholder is very important, as is the other aspect too of what are the rights that you have as a shareholder, but also, and more critically, are you that enterprise leader? Are you that enterprise person that should be a shareholder?
How has the landscape for feasible exit alternatives shifted over the last 10 years or so?
It shifted quite a lot. Number one, you're seeing more and more ESOPs in the market. An ESOP is a unique tool. It's a very broad 100% ownership base. It has some great tax advantages. And we're seeing a number of family-owned businesses that are transitioning to an ESOP because it gives them, quote unquote, a buyer. It has great tax incentives from a corporate standpoint and from a personal standpoint, but it also allows them to do it ratably in specific chunks over time. So we're seeing ESOPs being used quite a bit as a tool. They're definitely a retaining tool for employees as well because it allows them to build wealth. So that's one thing. The other is, as you think about companies over the last 5 years, we've seen significant growth in the construction industry. So firms are growing their top lines, they're growing their bottom lines. And what's happening is we're seeing a number of companies get to the point where their stock is almost too expensive to transition. So we're having to look at different means and methods to do that. We're seeing a number of firms look at the usage of LLCs as an entity type, because that gives you a lot more optionality in terms of how to share income, how to accelerate the transition process. Because look, it takes 7, 8, 10 years to transition a business over time. Those are the facts. That's what we see day to day and day out. But an LLC can give you a number of different ways to accelerate that in certain circumstances. So I think that's another foundational point where there's migration there. But the other thing from an LLC is that it allows you to kind of moderate that stock price because you're not effectively going through a purchase. It's more of a transition of equity at a certain level. And we know that a lot of companies have historically used the Olco Nuco model, which is another sharing model, and that plays into this as well. But I think firms, by and large, the larger firms are looking more broadly at broad employee ownership and going down the ranks, and as they get bigger, going deeper into the organization. And as you do that, shareholder criteria, shareholder expectations, valuation become very, very important tools.
And just to build on a comment earlier, choosing wisely when you go broad like that can be an incredible lever in terms of performance strategically. If you don't choose well, it serves in the opposite.
You're exactly right. If you make a mistake or if you go to broader ownership, it's hard to get that stock back. So yeah, you have to choose very wisely and make sure that your criteria is very refined and communicated.
So what role does estate planning play in ownership transition, and when should it enter the conversation?
It plays a very important role and should always be present. And it should be very present early on in the process, because having a clear, strong legal representation from an estate standpoint is very critical. Because look, I mean, as you transition, your assets are going to be leaving the business and going to you personally. So having a plan for that to minimize your estate taxes down the road is the big part of it. I wouldn't say that it's tip of the spear, but it's part of it. It can be used as a strategy. I mean, if you're a family-owned business and you're going to transition that business from an estate planning standpoint by gifting shares, look, that can be done. It's a great way to minimize estate taxes, but you have to balance kind of the liquidity needs that you have as well. The other thing to think about too is if you're using estate planning as the driver of this because you have a family business, the key question is where do the shares land? Are you going to transition those to family members that are both working in the business and those potentially working outside of the business? And we see that quite a bit. And that is a significant thing to consider because there are risks and really some complexity that comes with having owners outside of the business. So I think estate planning from a tax standpoint is important, but also just from a family standpoint in terms of how assets are shared and how shares are ultimately impacted within a family.
How should companies think about funding an internal ownership transition plan without putting the business at risk? You've touched on this a couple of times. I'd love to kind of dig deeper.
Yeah, there are a number of different ways to do it. And I think using corporate debt to fund a transition is a risky game. I mean, we definitely don't like to see GCs, et cetera, or primary construction firms with third-party debt anyway. So, utilizing that can be a challenge and a risk. It's really kind of a sharing model more than anything. I mean, you have to think of funding from the standpoint of a couple things. Number one, how much funding is coming from the employee? And your employees that are going to be buying into the business have a limited base of capital. So we like to see a little bit of skin in the game for risk alignment, but the majority of the purchase is going to be from using corporate capital. The old notion of buying yourself out with your own money. And while that might not sound good or land well from a mental standpoint, the reality is you're getting your equity out of the business. And there are a number of different ways that you can do that and also kind of maximize the value, which we'll get to in a minute. But I think from a funding standpoint, we see a use of promissory notes that are seller backed, that employees use kind of distributions to buy that down over time. That's a very nominal way to do it that has limited risk. Most of the funding comes from future profits, and you're going to be sharing profit streams that essentially allows employees after tax to buy your shares over time. And those are really the primary funding sources. So it's a little bit of capital skin in the game up front, but majority of corporate profits.
Matt, what are the most common mistakes firms make when planning for transition? And I guess if you could help leaders avoid just one, what would it be?
Obviously, the people side is extremely important, but not including the right shareholders in the mix and not communicating it well is of extreme importance. And you're going to have to make hard decisions. And how that's communicated from the standpoint of, within key employees and those that may be missing out is critical. And you have to go through that process, and it is challenging. The other is just waiting too long. The longer you wait, the harder it's going to be down the road. And if you do this timely and begin the practice of going through this process early enough, it's going to give you time to really mitigate the risk of business challenges, getting in a down market. It'll give you the chance to accelerate things when things are going well, but also maybe pulling back when things are not going well. So I think just the timing aspect of it is probably the most critical here.
This has been a great conversation. I really appreciate both of you taking the time to get together to share some of these insights. If each of you could leave one question ringing in an owner's mind as it relates to succession, what would it be? And Matt, I'll start with you.
The one question I would ask a business owner is, what's holding you back? The reality is your business is going to transition whether you like it or not. It's going to happen. And the risk of status quo sometimes is a primary risk for you. And we see a number of business owners that wait too long and their options are forced. So really getting ahead of the process and trying to, as Jake said, have the courage to move forward can be exceptionally important and reduce your overall transition risk over time.
It's a great answer. It's the concept of inertia, right? A body at rest stays at rest. Body in motion tends to stay in motion. It's going to happen one way or the other. It's a great, great answer. Jake, how about you? How would you answer that question? If you could leave just one thought or one question out there for owners contemplating a transition, what would it be?
It would have to be, what are the handful of big, scary questions you're just not addressing at this point? As I mentioned that earlier, Scott, about the courage that you have to have. What I can tell you with great certainty in this process is that at some point you will lose control of your business. And the question is, do you do it with your influence and control in place before that happens? And have you faced up to the really hard conversations? And And that is one thing I know with great certainty is that every time I've done this over a course of many decades, there's usually a handful of really hard questions that haven't been addressed. And so it's things like, what am I going to do next in my own life? And who really, truly has ownership mentality in this business? Have I adjusted my lifestyle to what I need to fund my lifestyle moving forward? Have I done enough to develop future leaders? Or am I just hoping that they'll develop on their own? But there's a whole series of tough questions that usually are the obstacles that most leaders haven't faced up to. And that's one of the things that we bring in the process is surfacing those hard issues and then putting a plan in place to be able to address those. In my experience, a great succession plan is 10% plan, 90% courage.
A great soundbite to end on.
Yeah.
Jake, Matt, thank you both. This was an outstanding conversation. I really appreciate your time and your expertise. Thank you for listening to another episode of FMI's Built In. Please remember to like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode.